Hello, listeners. I would like to welcome again into the Radio Free Thinker virtual studio, Iglika Ivanova. Iglika Ivanova is a public interest researcher at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. She has a master's degree in economics, which she uses to investigate issues and trends in healthcare, education, and social programs. And she examines the impact public services have on the quality of life. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on the show, Don.
Now, many of our listeners will scoff at the idea of poverty in a first world nation. Even if things are bad, they are far worse in places like Sudan and Ethiopia. That said, recently the UN Special Rapporteur for Food, Oliver DeShutter, commented that many Canadians suffer from food insecurity and that we should enact a national food strategy. Many of us have been haunted by the plight of many of our Aboriginal reserves with the lack of modern necessities like plumbing, heating, and safe running water. Do we have a problem with poverty in Canada? What are the numbers?
Absolutely, we have a problem with poverty. And I would say just because other countries may have worse problems than us, that doesn't get us off the hook. As a rich country, I think we should be particularly embarrassed by the fact that people don't have plumbing, heating, and running water in the 21st century. Because if we are one of the biggest economies in the world, and if we can't manage to eliminate abject poverty in our own country, how can we expect poorer countries to do that, right? We need to look at ourselves first before we go expecting other people to reduce poverty. I think it is important to look in the mirror. Besides the UN report on food that you mentioned, just the other day, there was another report from another UN body, UNICEF, that looked at child poverty in the industrialized world and highlighted Canada as a middle-of-the-road performer. Basically, it said that out of 35 industrialized countries, we are 18th in terms of child poverty. So just about in the middle, and that's pretty bad. You know, countries in Eastern Europe like Slovenia are doing better than us, and we've got a bigger share of kids in poverty than we have a share of adults. And that's a big problem because we know poverty is particularly bad in developmental years. So we certainly have problems in this country and we need to tackle them.
For those of us who have listened to American TV, a lot of the right-wing sort of commentators sort of have a war on the poor. And they bring up a lot of things that, well, what do you mean people are poor? They have refrigerators, they have air conditioners. These were luxuries 100 years ago. When you say poverty, what exactly do you mean? What does poverty look like in Canada?
Poverty is a relative thing, as you mentioned right now. It does depend on the state of the world as we are in. I would say that poverty is typically defined as a state of having inadequate financial resources. So it is linked to money in some way. And there's various income thresholds that can be used as of where the poverty level is to assess whether a particular person lives in poverty or not. But I think in general, it's probably accepted that poverty is beyond just material deprivation. It also includes inability to participate in society. So includes some form of concern about social exclusion. So are you able to, or do you have the financial means or the clothes and the shelter and the transportation needed to participate in society and be part of the society that happens around you? So I think that's the definition of poverty I would like to see in play more frequently. And the one of my favorite definitions actually is the one that comes from Canada's chief public health officer. And in his reports on the health of public health, the status of public health of Canada, takes a broader view of poverty that says it's not just about lack of financial resources, it's a cluster of disadvantages related to lack of financial resources. But it talks about lack of housing, lack of food, you know, and inability to participate in society.
That sounds very, very good definition there. There are many aspects to poverty that are important, but you know, we're sort of a skeptical program. And one of the things we like is sort of empirical evidence, i.e. numbers. Now, I might be putting you on the spot here, but can you provide any numbers to sort of support this view?
Numbers are good. And as I mentioned, usually we use some sort of financial resource threshold or income threshold to assess whether someone falls in poverty or not. In the United States, they actually have a formal definition of poverty that they use to determine eligibility for a variety of government subsidies. In Canada, we don't have a widely accepted measure of poverty or poverty threshold. Statistics Canada produces three separate measures that are often used as measures of poverty, but Statistics Canada insists they are measures of low income. I think it's too much time is spent arguing over definitions in general, and there's less time typically devoted to examining the issues, especially when you try to raise these issues with the government. They spend half the time arguing with the number you're using or the definition you're using. Well, really, we should talk about, you know, the problems people are faced. But let's pick the most commonly used set of income thresholds produced by Statistics Canada. It's called the low income cutoff after tax. So it accounts for the income people have after all taxes are paid and after all government subsidies and supports have been cashed in. So it would include things like welfare benefits, child benefits. According to this metric, about 9.5% of Canadians lived in poverty in 2009. This is the last year for which data is available. And in British Columbia, you might be interested to find out, we have higher levels of poverty than the national average. Here we have 12% of the population with incomes under that threshold compared to 9.5% in Canada. We are doing particularly bad in terms of child poverty, where again, we have the highest child poverty rate. So in, I guess I didn't mention that, we have the highest child poverty or the highest both adult general population and child poverty rate in the country of all provinces as British Columbia. And for child poverty in particular, we have been in the lead for 8 years. So for 8 years straight, we've had the worst child poverty rate. And that's 12%. So we have 12% both for general population and children here. And that's after all government support. Both child and adult poverty rates are higher before taxes. And because obviously we have support, we have child supports, we have welfare, we have a number of programs that provide support for the poorest among us. But even with that government support, we have 12% of people living in substantially lower income.
I could see in BC there's a significant number of immigrants who come to the West Coast. Montreal, Toronto would be similar aspects. In some parts of the country, there's a larger proportion of Aboriginal communities which tend to suffer much more from poverty. Is this sort of a systemic, institutional sort of poverty, or is this sort of a, current immigrant sort of system?
I think this is an excellent question. We find that certain groups are at higher risk of poverty than the general population, and you mentioned some of them already. Immigrants, and in particular very recent immigrants, immigrants who immigrated in the last 5 to 10 years, are at higher risk of poverty than the native-born population or immigrants who have a longer history of living in the country. But that can't explain why BC is doing so much worse than the rest of the country, because Toronto and Montreal also get almost as many immigrants as we do here as a share of population, yet they have substantially lower poverty rates on average. Aboriginal people are another group that are disproportionately affected by poverty. Single mothers and also women who live alone in their senior years, almost half of them live in poverty. There's huge problems there as well. Even though that's a relatively small share of the population, poverty in that group is quite prevalent.
What are the costs of poverty to the individual, family, community, or Canada at large?
I think that in general, there's a lot of research that links poverty to a whole range of negative consequences. So obviously that represents the cost of the individual. Poverty is linked to poorer health, to higher likelihood of getting involved in crime, to putting more demand on social and community services, to stress, to diminished school success for children, to lower literacy rates for adults, to do poorly in the labor market. So all these things are a tremendous personal tragedy for the individuals. I don't think you can put a number to that. But they also cost a lot of the community to deal with, because all these negative consequences are things we have to deal with. So if there's links between poverty and crime, then we have to deal with the fallout of higher crime. We have to deal with the poorer health that these people have. We have to deal with the emergency services they require and social services they require. It also generally puts the brake on our economy as well, because having high levels of poverty like we do here in British Columbia in particular means that there's a very large share of our population, you know, more than 1 in 9 persons, if you like, who doesn't have the opportunity to fully use their skills, you know, in society and in the labor market. So we all lose out from that. And if we provided opportunities for these people to fully realize their potential, we'd have a better economy as well. So there's huge social and economic cost to that. And economists have only recently turned to looking at the cost to society of dealing with the negative consequences of poverty. So I did a preliminary research project on that for the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives last year. And I find there that if you add up just the cost of poverty that come from increased criminal justice costs, increased healthcare costs, and sort of that loss of economic potential to the economy, you come to a very large ballpark number of about $8 to $9 billion for British Columbia alone. The number by itself isn't very interesting until you put it in context, but it's about 4% of our provincial economy. So that's a lot of money that we're spending every year dealing with negative consequences of poverty. Yet, because we don't account for it specifically that way, it's usually not talked about. And when people talk about reducing poverty and costs, the only cost discussed are the how much it would cost to reduce poverty. And it's assumed that tolerating poverty at its current levels is somehow free, like it doesn't cost us anything. But in fact, we are paying a lot as a society for tolerating high levels of poverty. And to the extent that we have very high child poverty rates, that means that we're setting ourselves up for higher costs in the future. Because if there's one area where the research is relatively non-controversial, it's the fact that poverty during key periods of brain development and childhood development in general is absolutely toxic and has lasting impacts throughout adulthood. So even if you took that child after that and they gave it higher income or improved their family income, that doesn't compensate for living in poverty during key developmental periods. So huge potential costs that we're leaving here for the next generation to deal with.
We will return after a little break.
Standing on a planet, really I'm just a speck, compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back. Related to poverty is the idea of the minimum wage. There's much debate about the cost and benefits to increasing it. However, another meme that has been arisen lately is a living wage. What's the difference between a minimum wage and a living wage?
Well, the minimum wage is the minimum legislated wage in a jurisdiction, usually government legislated, as the minimum acceptable wage that companies have to pay. It should be related to some sort of minimum acceptable notion of standard of living, like what you need to earn in our society. Because most people, if you talk to them, including government, would agree that if someone worked full-time, full year, they shouldn't be living in poverty, right? The wage should be such that if you worked full-time, you should be out of poverty. Most people don't think we should have working poverty. But you might be interested to know that that's not how we set the minimum wage in this country. We basically set it arbitrarily. People just decide what the number should be, and it's not related to any measure of poverty. The living wage is not legislated. It's something we just calculate for information purposes, if you like. But it's set to pass a higher test. It's not just looking to minimum acceptable quality of life or standard of living. It's looking at what would it take for a person or a family to not just not be in poverty, but be out of immediate sort of financial stress. Like, it wouldn't be a super comfortable life, but, you know, some sort of life that, you know, this person isn't in poverty. They don't have to worry about how they're going to pay the rent or put food on the table. They have a reasonable, you know, economic security, if you like. So our organization calculates the living wage for Vancouver, because the living wage is calculated on a community basis. So it takes into account the actual cost of living in a particular community. And to the extent that housing in particular, very different costs of housing in different communities, the living wage would be different. So we calculated the living wage for Vancouver, and we calculated with the families with children in mind. It's the wage that two parents working full-time need to earn in order for their family to pay its cost of living. So in Vancouver, for a family with children, that would include childcare, housing, healthcare, and a few other things that we budget for. You can look at the report, our website, the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. And we're not calling for the living wage to become a legislated wage from government. It's a call to large employers to pay their employees sufficiently so that they can provide for their families. It's a voluntary wage, but it does strike some conversation when you learn that the living wage for 2012 is $19.14 an hour in Vancouver. And you look at the statistics of how many people earn less than that.
Yes, quite many, I imagine.
Yes.
Actually, that being said, in the same sort of vein of this, in the classic nuclear family of the 1950s, where, you know, you had sort of the one wage earner in the family. And actually now, it seems like beginning of the last century to about the middle, people were working less and they were being paid more. And then around the 70s or 80s, that trend reversed. Now people are actually having to hold down two jobs and everyone in the household has to work. Is this a figment of my imagination? Or are people literally having to work more just to make ends meet?
Sadly, it's not a figment of your imagination. The statistics confirm it. The average hours of work for families across the income distribution are increasing. So families have to put more hours of work every year, and yet incomes are stagnating. So that is the really startling finding of the last 20 years, especially since the mid-1990s. We've seen a stagnation in the incomes at the middle. So I like to use median rather than average income. The median is the exact midpoint of the distribution where half, you know, of earned incomes are below and half are above, because it's not as sensitive to outliers as the average. And we know that we have outliers, because if you've read any reports recently about how much CEOs are being paid, we know there's some very large wages at the very top. But if we're interested in the experience of the majority of the population who doesn't earn these wages, you look at what's happening at the median. And the median wage for full-time, full-year workers is actually lower in British Columbia now than it used to be in the late 70s. So we've seen a decline after you adjust for inflation in the wage of full-time workers. And it is very curious that we've seen that, because it's not that we haven't had economic growth over this period. In fact, even if you look at GDP per capita, so adjusted for population growth, you look at how much our economy has grown per capita after you adjust for inflation, we have almost a 25% increase in GDP per capita since the late 70s, and yet median wages are stagnant. And that's because it has to do with bargaining power. A lot higher share of GDP or of our economy is going towards the owners of capital, you know, and a lot less is going towards wages. So we have seen this shift. And when it is a problem, because it's not just about rising income inequality, it's also about stagnating wages and the fact that people are working more, but are not a large number of people, even at the middle of the income distribution, are not seeing any benefit from the increased economic growth of the last 30 years.
A number of people have argued, though, that, you know, if you increase wages, you'll end up killing jobs. Is that true?
I don't think that's true. I think most of the research does not support that kind of argument. If you think back to industrialists like Henry Ford, who advocated for paying your workers as much as you possibly can in order to ensure that they can afford to buy your product, that was the key argument at the time, because he believed that increasing purchasing power for most workers was what forced a business success in America. So he did increase wages for his workers. But I think that as of late, we've seen certainly that businesses prefer to keep wages low and pocket all the profits, because profits are, you know, at record high levels in North America, both in the United States and in Canada. Well, as I mentioned, wages as a share of the economy have been falling. So I think it's some public policy choices that we've made in terms of employment standards and reducing workers' rights that are leading bargaining power for companies, and they're basically able to extract concessions and pay lower wages rather than worrying that, having to increase wages is going to kill jobs. I think that's just the justification that people use when they don't want to share their high profits in terms of wages.
We discussed earlier off-air an experiment done in Manitoba in the 70s called MIMCOM. The NDP government at the time wished to be the testing ground for a guaranteed income project. This project included 1,000 families, which would be given a check each month. Those who earned nothing would get 100% of this sort of subsidy. Those who made some money would get less based on their earnings, but everyone kind of got a little bit of something. So there was sort of an incentive to go out and work, but even if you couldn't, you still had a guaranteed income. It ran from 1974 to the fall of the NDP government in 79. Now, out of one of the things that had come out of this was it dispelled some of the myths that if people were allowed to just sit home and do nothing, they would, that people would still go out and get work. It worked quite well for the community at hand. And this kind of begs the question, is the best way to eliminate poverty via wages? Are there alternatives like MIMCOM?
I don't think that we've found for sure yet what the best way is. I think the experiment in Manitoba was very interesting, and it's gotten quite a lot of press recently because apparently, some research was done immediately after the experiment was conducted in the late 70s, but then it was largely buried. The governments of the day decided they weren't interested in going in that direction, so they just stopped doing any research on the data. And very recently, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, someone stumbled on the files, they digitized them all, and started doing work with the actual data collected during that experiment. So that's why we see a revival of interest in that policy. But I think in general, we have a number of policy levers that we can look at to help Canada deal with its poverty problem. I think personally that there isn't a single policy that will solve all the problems, because reducing poverty is more than just providing income. It's also about providing services. And in general, we know that there's a lot of policies and programs that we have that impact standard of living. So I don't think it's as easy as just giving everyone a check, at least not in the medium term. Maybe in Horizon we can get there. There's a report that out in 2009 called Possibilities and Prospects, the Debate Over Guaranteed Income, and read more about the exact details of these kind of guaranteed income policies and what the pros and cons are. And we have done a lot of research. In 2008, the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives led a big research project with a number of community groups here that work on poverty, and a number of academics, both UBC and SFU academics in sociology and economics and other social sciences that look at the issues of poverty. So we developed a very broad-based poverty reduction plan for British Columbia. What these groups came up and academics came up with was 7 priority areas for government investment in poverty reduction. And they believe that all 7 areas are important to target, because I think it is important to think about a multi-pronged strategy. So these include providing adequate income support for the people who cannot be expected to work, because we know that most people can support themselves through work, but people with disabilities or other mental health or other health problems, whether they're temporary or they're permanent disabilities, there's a certain group of the population that cannot be expected to work. So we need to have accessible and adequate income support for that. We need to improve working conditions and earnings for those in the low-wage workforce. And there's a lot of conversations we can have about working poverty, and we probably should at another show. There's food security. The UN rapporteur highlighted that, but that's an essential aspect of poverty reduction, is improving food security. There's homelessness and housing. There's childcare. It's a huge issue we find with child poverty, is the lack of access to early learning and childcare opportunities. Area number 6 was increased training and education opportunities for low-income people. And the last one was mental health and home support services for people who need them. So we need not just income supports, but also services to provide for health, mental health, housing, food, and these areas. So I think that this is very important. The encouraging part is that most Canadian provinces have realized that poverty is a serious problem in this country and actually have provincially poverty reduction plan. In fact, all provinces except for Saskatchewan and British Columbia, so that includes Alberta, have poverty reduction plan or have plans in place to put one together. So we are one of the 2 provinces in the country that doesn't have a government priority to reduce poverty, even though we are the province with as poverty rate. But I'm hopeful that our government will soon agree that this is a priority and adopt it. And one thing that gives me a lot of hope and optimism is that in most of these other provinces that they have started having poverty reduction plan, first, it was an issue of all party agreements. So even though there's typical partisan squabbling everywhere, just like in British Columbia, on the issue of poverty, the parties were able to come together and say, this isn't a partisan thing. This is a problem for our communities, and we're all going to work together. And also, the provinces that have been longest at it actually have results. Newfoundland is a particularly good story because in the early 2000s, Newfoundland had the highest poverty rates in Canada, along with British Columbia. But the British Columbia government and the Newfoundland government responded very differently to it. The British Columbia government, premier at the time was Gordon Campbell, disputed the numbers, argued with the appropriate definitions of poverty, and generally tried to say that there is no problem. The premier of Newfoundland, who was a conservative premier at the time, Danny Williams, he accepted the numbers and he said, you know, I accept these data. It is unacceptable that we have such high poverty rate and my government is going to do something about it. And he actually implemented the poverty reduction plan. And now they are one of the provinces with lower adult poverty rate as well. So they are in the lower end of all provinces in terms of poverty rate, while British Columbia continues to be the highest. So I really think that the poverty reduction plans can work when they're supported by political will and supported by some financing from government. And I hope to see one in British Columbia soon.
Maybe it just points out that cod is better brain food than salmon. Who knows?
I don't know about that.
Thank you for your time today, Iglika Ivanova.
Thank you.
Radio Free Thinker will return after this break.